From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the chilling 911 calls from last year's Newtown School shooting are released despite outcry from the families of the victims.
Rereading the words and listening to the words of the day, the moment-to-moment actions that had happened, and it's very hurtful.
We hear from Beirut as US officials say the Syrian crisis has increased the threat of terrorist attacks against Americans. Immigration reform dominates our coverage from the capital, and we're in New York to hear the story of Tommy the Chimp and his legal fight for liberty.
He is living in a small cage, in a dark, kind of cavernous shed as a used trailer lot in upstate New York.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. China has warned U.S. Vice President Joe Biden not to repeat erroneous remarks on its new air defense zone as he arrived in Beijing for high-level talks. The warning came from Chinese state media. As the standoff deepens over China's unilateral move to control the skies over the East China Sea, Nina Maria Potts has more.
In a warning to U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, Chinese state media said he should not repeat the same mistake he'd made on his visit to Tokyo, where he reaffirmed the U.S. alliance with Japan. His trip to Asia has been overshadowed by a deepening row over China's recently declared air defense zone, which covers islands controlled by Japan but disputed by Beijing. The vice president is now in Beijing for talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang. Going into the meetings, he said he'd raise the issue with the Chinese government in great detail.
One of Hezbollah's top commanders has been assassinated. The Lebanese militant group is blaming Israel for the killing of Hassan Lakis outside his home near Beirut. Israel has denied responsibility for the commander's death. A growing number of Americans believe that U.S. global power is on the decline, according to a new Pew Research poll. The research also shows that a majority of the 2,000 Americans surveyed want the U.S. to be more disengaged from the rest of the world on strategic issues. Daniel Wrenches explains.
53% of those polled in the 2013 America's Place in the World survey say the U.S. has a less important and powerful role than 10 years ago. 52% say the U.S. should mind its own business internationally and let other countries get along the best they can on their own. The survey demonstrates that by a margin of 56 to 34%, the public disapproves of President Obama's handling of foreign policy. These figures reflect the most isolationist streak in American attitude since the survey began in 1964.
The United Nations nuclear watchdog says a truck carrying radioactive material has been stolen in Mexico. The International Atomic Energy Agency is warning that the material could be extremely dangerous, prompting concern that it could be used to make a dirty bomb. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The truck was taking the radioactive material used for cancer treatments to a storage facility when it was stolen near Mexico City. So far, the International Atomic Energy Agency has not said exactly how much material was inside the 2.5-ton vehicle. The cobalt-60 teletherapy source has protective shielding, but the agency warns if removed from that, it could be extremely dangerous. The worry is it could be used to make a so-called dirty bomb, as cobalt-60 is a radioactive source able to make such devices when added to explosives.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A woman in the U.S. state of Iowa serving a life sentence for murder has been granted parole and compassionate release after receiving a terminal cancer diagnosis. This is the first such decision by Iowa courts after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional. Priscilla Huff has more.
Chris Fetters has been diagnosed with inoperable stage 4 breast cancer, which has also spread to her bones. She is serving a life sentence in an Iowa prison for murdering her aunt. a crime she committed when she was 14. At the time, the Iowa courts threw the books at her, applying a mandatory life sentence. Following the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that mandatory life sentences for juvenile criminals is unconstitutional, the Iowa Board of Parole has granted her compassionate release to the Hospice of Central Iowa. Once the state's youngest inmate serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole, now doctors say it is unknown how much longer Chris Fetters will live.
In South Korea, the world's largest floating facility is out on the water for the first time. Shell Corp's vessel, called the Prelude, is longer than the Empire State Building and weighs 600,000 tons. It will anchor off Australia's coast, where it's set to help produce natural gas for a quarter of a century. And it's a first for animal rights advocates, as one New York-based nonprofit is fighting for legal personhood for chimpanzees, arguing that their advanced cognitive capabilities should allow them greater legal protection. The Non-Human Rights Project says they filed the lawsuit on behalf of a 26-year-old chimpanzee named Tommy. For the past 10 years, Tommy's lived in an animal sanctuary, and his owner argues that he's led a safe and healthy existence. But the advocates disagree, and now New York State courts are set to confront an ethical and existential dilemma. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I would not want to read those painful things and the step-by-steps. It's hurtful. It's just rereading the words and listening to the words of the day, the moment-to-moment actions that had happened. And it's very hurtful. And I don't see that there should be a need that the public needs to relive that. It's not going to help. And I'm not interested in it, and I don't see that there's a need because they still don't know why, what this gentleman had in mind and why he did it.
Sandy Hook resident Anne-Marie Merlot expressing her concerns ahead of today's release of the 911 recordings from the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown almost a year ago. Police recordings from the massacre that left 20 children and 6 educators dead were released on Wednesday. The move to release the audio recordings came after a Connecticut judge denied an appeal by the state attorney to conceal the tapes for the anguish it could cause families. Most family members of the victims are against the move, but opinion is divided, with some Freedom of Information advocates claiming it should be made public. To get more insight on the issue, I spoke to Dr. Nancy Zass, a clinical psychologist and associate professor in the forensic department at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, and began by asking her why this had triggered such fierce debate.
Well, I think it's twofold. One, there seems to be the possibility of a legitimate concern with regard to analyzing the response of emergency responders and law enforcement. So there's the sense that perhaps this could be an after-action review of sorts. The flip side of that, though, is that you're likely to rip the scab off of wounds that have not healed and cause a great deal of emotion for the victims, families, for the community, for the school. And is that really necessary?
I suppose a counter argument to that, or certainly the one which is taking prominence, is that there is something to be learned from the release of these tapes.
There is something that can be learned. We can always look at a critical incident and we can analyze the response of multiple people involved, as long as we're doing that with a professional perspective and with the sense that hindsight is always 20/20. I think the concern here is that perhaps that freedom of information and that after-action review is actually being used to increase ratings at the expense of the victims' families. And I think that's the rub, is how do we balance the victims' families and sensitivity for this horrific event with a freedom of information and the public's right to know.
You talked about the anguish and ripping that emotional scab off. I mean, we've also got the one-year anniversary of this massacre.
Which is just next week, and the holidays.
That's right. So, I mean, talk about that compounding the grief. What are these families going through, especially on this grim anniversary?
Anguish is a perfect word. There is such a trauma here that these lives were taken, you know, so young and in such a horrific act of violence. And then you have this will be their first holidays, you know, whether it's Hanukkah or whether it's Christmas or whether it's some other holiday, that they will be celebrating without those loved ones. So anniversaries are very difficult. And to have the anniversary of the death be so close to holidays is really, really difficult. And these things just reopen the wounds. You know, every time there's a legal issue or every time the case is reopened in the news, you know, we know that this affects families. And certainly we can say, well, gosh, you know, families will try not to listen to the news, but it's difficult when it's everywhere.
A family member of one of the victims I read said, you know, one of the major issues here is that she has no control over the media's use of these recordings, and at any time she can hear her own voice and be taken back, transported to that sad, tragic day.
That is very true. And if any of these people are actually suffering from, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, we know that these things are triggers and that emotionally the person does go right back to that intensity and to that trauma and to that emotional horror of that time. So that is very difficult. It is. And you know, the lack of control is something that victims talk about across the board. They had no control in the act itself, and they have no control over some of these kinds of things, some of the legal decisions that are made, some of the prosecutions, you know, some of how this is broadcast in the media. And that lack of control also harks them back to the lack of control that they had on that very day.
Dr. Nancy Zars. Now, as prospects for immigration reform grow dimmer during Congress's end-of-year scramble and President Obama refuses to take more executive actions to curb deportations, activists from across the country are ramping up political pressure. A congressional staffer announced Wednesday that she's quitting her job in order to dedicate herself full-time to fighting her mother's deportation. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has more.
Huddled together in the cold outside the marble Capitol building, a group of immigration activists from Florida and Arizona sang and chanted, calling on Republican House Speaker John Boehner to commit to bringing forward an immigration reform bill. They also called on President Obama to issue more executive actions to shield people like Guadalupe Maria Arriola, who raised 5 children in the U.S., from deportation. Arriola said she didn't come to the U.S. 16 years ago for fun. After applying for a visa and being denied, she crossed the desert with her 5 children to escape domestic violence. She then lived and worked for many years in Mesa, Arizona, putting some of her children through college. But this past January, she and one of her sons were arrested and put in deportation proceedings. She was handcuffed and on a bus to Mexico when the bus was told to turn around. She learned that pressure from her local community had convinced the Department of Homeland Security to grant her a 1-year stay of deportation. But that year will be up in just a few weeks.
If we wait for immigration reform to happen with this Congress, then we're going to lose a lot of people.
That's Arriola's daughter, Erica Andiola, co-founder of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, and until this week, a staffer in the D.C. office of Arizona Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. Andiola announced this week that she'll be resigning from that job in order to dedicate herself to community organizing and pressuring the administration not to deport her mother. She said she feels she can do much more on the outside than on the inside of government.
After a year that I've been working in Congress, I learned that Congress right now is a place where politics are more important than people. Where instead of fighting for something that's gonna get all of these amazing people and families together and not be deported, they're worrying more about next election and about so many other things that are not as urgent as having a family together for this Christmas and for the next Christmas, for any other Christmas.
Andiola's former boss, Representative Sinema, is sending letters to Immigration and Customs Enforcement on behalf of Arriola. She also promised Wednesday to keep pushing in the House for a vote on one of the many bills that would address immigration reform.
Erica's situation and Erica's mother's situation is not unique. Thousands of families across this country and thousands of families in Arizona face a dilemma just like theirs every single day. Because our Congress has failed to take action on immigration reform that provides for meaningful reform to keep families together.
As they participate in protests this week outside of Speaker Boehner's office, Andiola and her mother are also petitioning both Immigration and Customs Enforcement and President Obama himself for relief.
There are a number of things that this president has in his authority to stem the tide of deportations.
That's New York-based immigration attorney Matthew Colkin. He says one of the best and easiest things the president could do is expand the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program to include the families of the young people receiving that status. He said the president could also direct Immigration and Customs Enforcement to grant what's called parole in place to all spouses and immediate family of U.S. citizens, allowing them to stay in the U.S. while applying for a green card. Colkin said these measures alone would spare hundreds of thousands of people with family and good records from deportation. Immigration reform advocates did receive one piece of encouraging news this week. Speaker Boehner announced that he's hiring a new policy aide to work specifically on immigration, and his spokesperson said he, quote, remains hopeful that we can enact step-by-step common-sense immigration reform. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Worsening by the day. That's how the UN has described the humanitarian crisis devastating the civilian population caught up in the Syrian conflict. This assessment comes after leaders of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees said Al-Qaeda's presence in Syria has increased the threat of a terrorist attack on the US. Earlier, I discussed the situation with Nicholas Blandford, Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, but began by asking him about the assassination of a Hezbollah commander.
Hassan Lakis was killed late last night in Beirut, apparently by an assassin wielding a silenced 9mm pistol. He was a senior figure within Hezbollah's military, and it seems, judging from reports that have been circulating today, they had a number of responsibilities, but perhaps the more interesting ones were involvement in the procurement of advanced weapon systems for Hezbollah's military wing. And apparently he was liaising with the Syrian intelligence and Iranian intelligence and was quite a senior figure. Now, of course, as you say, the Hezbollah has blamed Israel for the assassination, which is a natural reaction, I think, by Hezbollah. And it's not necessarily an inaccurate accusation either. The other potential culprits would be drawn from militant Sunni groups who are opposed to Hezbollah's intervention in Syria. Hezbollah has come under attack in Lebanon on several occasions this year.
If I can focus it on Syria, leaders are here in the United States, leaders of the Senate and House Intelligence Committee said America wasn't safer from terrorist attacks than in 2011. They've based that in part on statements from Al-Qaeda saying the group could establish a base in Syria that's capable of threatening Europe and the United States. How legitimate do you think that threat is?
We've seen since the uprising began against the regime of Bashar al-Assad 2.5 years ago now, a gradual radicalization of the opposition. So, you know, you may recall that at the beginning, the dynamic was very much democracy, calling protesters, waving placards outside the mosques after Friday prayers and being gunned down by the Syrian army. And that, of course, led to a reaction where the protesters picked up guns and started shooting back. And over the course of the last couple of years, when the conflict really became an armed conflict rather than a series of protests, we've seen a steady radicalization of the armed opposition, to the extent that the dominant fighting forces now amongst the rebel groups are actually those that are affiliated to Al-Qaeda. We're seeing more moderate groups that espouse a moderate Islam, if you like, finding that they need to become more radical to attract the rather scarce funds and weapons that are coming from Gulf sources, for example. So there's been the steady trait, which also plays very much into the hands of the Assad regime, who can point to their opponents in Syria and tell the West, look, this is what you're going to get if I'm allowed to fall. You're going to see Syria turning into a haven for al-Qaeda. And I think that that argument is resonating quite a bit, certainly with the US and Europe.
Nicholas Blanford in Beirut. A UK jury in the trial of two men accused of killing the British soldier Lee Rigby has heard that one of his alleged killers showed no regret or remorse. During a police interview played to court, Michael Adebalajo criticised British politicians and said he was upset about the deaths of people in Muslim lands. He went on to describe the graphic injuries inflicted on Mr. Rigby during the attack that took place earlier this year in southeast London. Earlier, I spoke to FSN's Ollie Barrett and began by asking him about the psychiatric assessment presented to the court.
Yes, that's right. The court has been hearing from a forensic psychiatrist who assessed 28-year-old Michael Adebalajo as of being of entirely stable mental health and also of showing no regret or remorse for the alleged killing. Tim McInerney also told the jury that Mr. Adebalajo had warned him that he would be a continuing risk to the British military. The psychiatrist told the jury as well that Mr. Adebalajo had stressed he hadn't taken any illicit substances or felt unwell in the run-up to the events that took place on the 22nd of May. And Michael Adebalajo is the man whose picture was seen around the world on mobile phone footage after Lee Rigby's death, as he spoke to onlookers at the scene of the incident.
What has the jury been told about Michael Adebalajo's dealings with police?
Well, a video was shown to court of a long police interview with Michael Adebalajo. He spoke at one point for over 30 minutes, almost without drawing breath, at which point he took a very short drink and then carried on talking. He complained in the police interview about politicians like Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, brainwashing people, according to Michael Adebalajo. The jury also saw him saying that British leaders rule over people in a wicked, corrupt and oppressive manner. The jury also heard in a police interview Adebalajo questioned about the claim that he had told hospital staff, "Why do you need forensics? I'm not denying murder." Well, Adebalajo then went on to tell police that it was very unlikely he would have said the word murder, but that he would have said, "I'm not denying anything." He also told police, the jury heard, that it gave him little joy to approach anybody and slay them. He also told police, the jury heard, that he is not a man who enjoys watching horror movies. "This is not my character," he said.
What has Michael Adebalajo said about being British?
Yes, in these police interviews, the jury heard, Michael Adebalajo said that he was born in Britain, grew up in Britain, raised in Britain, educated in Britain, and that he had experienced many good things in Britain. But he told police that the word British is now associated with murder, pillaging and rape, in his words. He also told police, the court heard, that there is an ongoing war between Muslims and the British people, and that he was a soldier of Allah.
And Ollie, some graphic detail about Lee Rigby's injuries.
Yes, Lee Rigby's family left court, understandably, really, as the pathologist began to tell the jury the extent of Lee Rigby's injuries in Woolwich. The pathologist telling the jury that Rigby had a small fracture to the left side of his back from an initial impact with a car that was driven into him, plus neck incisions which suggested severe force. The jury heard that some of the stab wounds inflicted on Lee Rigby were up to 12 centimetres deep. And the pathologist also told the court that the incisions almost totally encircled the neck of Lee Rigby.
But both defendants deny murder.
Yes, Michael Adebalajo, who is 28, and Michael Adebawale, who is 22, both deny murdering Lee Rigby. Both men also deny attempting to murder a police officer and conspiracy to murder a police officer. Lee Rigby, Fusilier Lee Rigby, was killed as he walked back to his barracks in Woolwich, which is in southeast London, on the 22nd of May. We are 4 days into the trial over his death, and that trial continues.
FSN's Ollie Barrett in London. This is FSN Reports. Finally tonight, Tommy the chimp has been making headlines here in the US after an animal rights group has taken his owners to court over the issue of animal liberties. Stephen M. Wise heads up the Non-Human Rights Project and has been at a court in New York demanding Tommy be recognised as a legal person with the right to liberty. To get more on Tommy the chimp's case, FSN's Rebecca Hume earlier spoke to Michael Mountain, communications director with the Non-Human Rights Project.
I think the main reason really is that for those of us who have been in what is called the animal rights movement, and there are so many animal rights organizations and so on, but to this day, no animals outside of us humans have any actual rights at all.
Can you sort of explain how animal rights differs to animal welfare? I mean, I understand we're talking about two different things here. What kind of rights are you talking about that these animals should have?
We're talking specifically about the fundamental rights of animals who are extremely cognitively complex, are self-aware, and are autonomous, meaning that they don't just operate off kind of blind instinct, but have the ability to plan their day, think about their future, make decisions on their own, use tools, and, you know, all the kind of things that we're learning more and more about in science. And this applies specifically, the ones that we have the evidence for are the great apes, such as chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, and gorillas, and also several kinds of dolphins and whales.
Now, obviously, these animals can't live independently in the way humans can. They have to live in some sort of conditions, particularly if they've been taken from the wild and sort of been born and bred in captivity. So what kind of conditions are you sort of looking for these animals? I mean, just a side note here that in Tommy's case, it's been said that he was actually rescued from terrible conditions in the entertainment industry. So what's actually wrong with where he lives now, and what kind of conditions are you petitioning for such animals?
Well, the conditions that we found him in is that he is living in a small cage in a dark kind of cavernous shed as a used trailer lot in upstate New York. What we're asking is that the judge declare that he has the right to bodily liberty and then transfer him to one of the best sanctuaries in the country. They're all under the kind of auspices overall of the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance.
In terms of what your group's trying to do in the long term, can you sort of explain those long-term goals? What sort of conditions are expected for all of these animals, and what you aim to do long term?
What we are certainly setting out to do is to set a series of precedents that over the long term will begin to change the way we all view these highly cognitively complex, self-aware animals.
Michael Mountain. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show. Email us reports@featurestory.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Hume and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.